I would like to introduce Dawn C, who has been a part of my recovery for over 30 years and has taught me a lot of things, not only about food, but about living in general. And I could think of nobody better to talk today about what happens when we come in to program, and not only what happens within us, but what happens without us. So Dawn, you have 45 minutes to an hour. At what point would you like me to say anything?
Well, I've got 45 minutes because I'm going to talk, and I might not do that much, but that will give me a good wind up.
Okay, good. I will let you know.
Okay.
Here's Dawn.
Good morning, everyone. It's good afternoon, really. It's a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to share my strength and hope and to explain the journey, at least my journey, of walking through this program and walking through the steps and the recovery and joy that I have received in the change that has happened in me. I cannot tell you the change in other people, but I can tell you the result of the change in me and how it has rippled through my family in many ways, in many times. And then there have also been times when I saw the withdrawal from the new change in me that has caused some difficulty in my family, because sometimes they want the old Dawn back. And through the good news of the program, I remember her, but that's not who I am today, through the grace of God. I came in this program in 1976. I was 44 years old and had been in Al-Anon since I was 28. I'd had a very difficult time getting an understanding what Al-Anon was about. And the reason for that was that I was so busy eating that I just did not have the, I couldn't understand what they wanted from me. What I wanted was to change my family, my husband, my children. I wanted to make them as I wanted them to be. And I couldn't understand that the steps were for me. I kept trying so hard to see what I could do. And the motive was not always good. I wanted to change them so they would really appreciate me. You know, I wanted to change them so they would stand somewhere in some place and say, I owe it all to her, our wonderful mother. Well, this is Mother's Weekend, and I don't even know who I'm going to hear from, you know. But the good news is I did the best I could. And I'm satisfied with that today, because in much of my life, especially as a young mother, I was so nuts that I'm certain some of the messages I got over were not really relevant, because I was caught up in self. When at 44, coming into these rooms, I did not know what to expect. I've been on every diet you can think of. I've been Weight Watchers, and I was even asked at one point to stop coming. I've been in diet workshops. I've, you name it, I've tried hypnosis. I've done everything but have my teeth stapled together, and I would have done that. But I also would have gotten a straw and put that stuff through a blender so that I could get to the drug of my choice, you know, which was not just sugar and white flour. My disease includes food clear. Food does for me what nothing else can do. It satisfies a longing and an emptiness in me that nothing else could do. I'm not an alcoholic, but if I had continued my sponsor said, this is what happened. My sponsor said that when I stopped eating sugar and white flour, the first thing I wanted was to have a drink. I was going to say with my dinner, I said, how about if I just add a martini? And she said, you're going for the sugar. Maybe not. Maybe you shouldn't do that. And that's the good news. I chose not to do that because I think that between compulsive eating and the longing for something sweet was a connection that probably my body is alcoholic. It just never did for me what food did. I always noticed when we were young and we went to parties, and that was before my husband was sober, one drink, what it did for me was turn me on to food. And you could have the rest of that, but please, please, just don't damage or don't bother my food. I came in at 44 and I came in with enthusiasm because when they had the steps hanging in front of me in that room in Syracuse, New York, I knew that I had been trying to do those steps for years and years and could not understand why I hadn't changed, because I used to say things like I'm powerless over, and then I'd put in whatever it was, but it was never me. I thought that I had this ability. And when I got to the place where I realized I was powerless over food and places and people and situations, I began to understand that the transformation that had to take place was not in the children being better or my husband loving me more, but on the inside of me where the soul was. And sponsor gave me a sign to put on my refrigerator and to put on my dresser. On the refrigerator, it said, ain't no love in here. Not isn't, but ain't no love in here. And the other one was on my mirror in my bedroom, so you're looking at the problem. And that was a revelation to me, looking at the problem. I had 4 children in my life. I had 3 children were at home when my recovery began. My husband and I were not the best of couples, but we've been together for many years. And the problem was often he was a recovering alcoholic, and his sobriety was not always what it should be in my estimation, which doesn't always mean the right thing, but as I thought. And for some reason, I always knew how to measure his sobriety when I couldn't keep my own abstinence. It was very interesting that I was always working on somebody else. When I came in and I began to understand that I was powerless over people, places, and things, and that my life was unmanageable. And I said, well, who else is going to manage it? Not me. And then we got to that second step, which said, well, here's what's going to happen. You're going to turn your will and your life. You're going to understand that your thinking is not clear. Your mental state is not real. What has to happen is that you have to get under new management. And so the management can't be me. And it can't necessarily be somebody outside of me. It can't be one of these people that I trust with all my heart. It has to be something bigger than that. I have to find a higher power or some kind of source that would give me a sense of understanding that the problem with me, but that I could get better. And then the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, even before you get to the 4th step, it says that you are born again. And that really touched me because I've always, in my church experience, and I've been in many churches, I've been a Methodist, I've been Baptist, I've been African Methodist, I've been Catholic, I've been Episcopalian, I've been Church of God in Christ, you name whatever it is, I've been out there trying to fill the empty spot in me. But the big book said that I could be born again. And that gave me an opportunity to look back and begin the journey of what got me here. I came from a family that was a wonderful family, but we had our own state of dysfunction. My father was a bishop in the Methodist Church, very wonderful man. My mother was his companion, and together they worked all their lives trying to do the right thing. And sometimes they were so busy that I never felt part of the group. Mama had 8 children and 5 survived, and I was the last, and I felt on the outside looking in. My grandfather, who was my caretaker, sexually abused me, and yet my grandfather was my source of strength and hope because I loved him more than anybody in the world. I didn't understand what sexual abuse meant, nor did I understand that it was damaging me. I went through life looking for some kind of love that would make me feel clean. I joined church every Sunday when I was a kid, trying to be cleaned up. And I couldn't seem to feel that power that would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I didn't have anybody to talk to about that situation. So all I did was just be frightened Dawn, afraid of my shadow. I used to cry at night, but I don't know how my parents ever had any kind of relationships, because I called them all night long and they would come to my bed, sit down for a minute, and then go back. But I was scared that somebody was going to come and harm me. I grew up in that home, and by the time I was a young person, we had moved from the neighborhood that we grew in up into an Episcopal residence, and that meant I lost all my friends. And my friends always thought that because we had changed locations, that the family had changed. In other words, my friends were overwhelmed when they'd come to the Episcopal residence because the house was big and there was all kinds of things in the house none of us had ever seen. And I never felt a part of the group again. And then my dad began traveling a lot. He got in the Methodist Church, you get certain districts that last for 4 to 8 years. And sometimes he and Mama would travel because we still stayed in Detroit. And I began singing, and that was going to be how I fit in. I joined choir, and I became a soloist in the choir, and that was real exciting for me, because I wasn't a very gifted person in many ways. And in becoming a soloist there, the choir director paid attention to me. And I always wanted somebody. And I think somewhere in me, he was older. I was 18 and he was in his 40s. And I was fascinated by this man who paid attention to me. And he gave me the solos. And one day on the way home from church, he took advantage of me. The sad part was not that he took advantage of me, but was that I thought doing what he did meant that he loved me. And I remember we went to Europe that summer, my mother, father, and my sister and I. And on the boat, I was sick the whole way. And I realized on the boat that there was something wrong with me. And I came home and I didn't tell anybody, but I kept getting bigger and bigger. I never didn't tell the man. I didn't tell my mama. I didn't tell my daddy. But I had this feeling that now I have this something inside me that's growing. And I felt full. I felt that I had an opportunity to give love to an individual who would love me and be with me all the time. No realistic thoughts, just a little insanity. And I remember when I was at least 9 and a half months pregnant, I was over what the time should be. I woke up one morning and my water broke and I had nobody to talk to. I went downtown that day on the streetcar. I remember the streetcar bumping back and forward. And I didn't know what was happening. I said, Lord, I thought I might deliver this baby there. I came back home and I tried to tell my parents, and my dad was busy. He had a meeting of his ministers, and I couldn't get his attention. And so I spent another night in my bed, not knowing what to do. I woke up the next morning and I couldn't put my shoes on. My feet were so big and swollen. But I got in a cab and Mama said, "What are you wearing those boots?" The other thing she said is, "When are you going to lose that weight?" And I said, I thought to myself, eventually. I got to the doctor. I got to the hospital and I said, "I don't have a doctor." And the abundance of God's love in my life has been overwhelming. There was this man standing next to me and he said, "I don't know who she is, but she's going to be my patient." And I got went in the hospital, and that night, the baby was born. 10 pounds, 4 ounces, a baby boy. And they put that baby in my arms, and I felt this sense of, oh, now I know my purpose. He was so beautiful. And I said, "I will raise this child, and I'm going to be the best mother in the world." And then somebody called my parents, and they showed up at the hospital. They both were just amazed, because Mom and Daddy knew I didn't even date, so how could this happen? And Mama said, "How could I go through this and not even tell her?" She thought maybe she had failed because I never said anything. But Dad said, "Don't worry about it. We've got this thing worked out for you." And I felt this great sense of satisfaction. And we got in the car. On our way home from the hospital, my mother, my dad, my brother, my sister, and I, and I sat in the back seat and I was holding this beautiful baby. And we got to the stoplight. The woman opened the door of the car and she took the baby out of my hand. And she closed the door of the car and I screamed. I couldn't stop screaming. And they just took me home. And my dad said, "Put yourself together." My dad said, "It's going to work out." And I said, "Where is he?" And I would go from church to church. I looked everywhere for him and I couldn't find him. And one day I looked in the mirror and I said, "Here's what's wrong with me. I'm fat. If I lose this weight, then things are going to be all right." And so I got busy working on the outer myself. I worked on the outer self. And after about a year, this grossly obese young woman became a beautiful young woman. Sometimes it's hard to see that now because I'm 91. But there was this beautiful young woman. My figure was good. I was, boys and young men were stopping their cars to say, "Oh my goodness, who is that?" They said to my brother, "What happened to your sister?" And my brother even let me ride in the car with him. He used to never let me ride in the car with him. But he let me ride in the front seat, you know? So I knew I was looking good. So the thought came to my mind, okay, I fixed the outside. Now I'm gonna find a husband and I'm gonna have a family again. I'm gonna start this over again because I couldn't stop this wailing and looking for my boy. And so this young man that was worked for the city came and said, "I've fallen in love with you, Dawn." His name was James. And he said, "Will you marry me?" And I said, "Yes." And there was another young man who was pastoring a Baptist church. And he was doing very well. And he said, "I've fallen in love with the outside of you." He didn't say outside. "I fell in love with you." But I knew it was the outside because nothing had changed on the inside. And inside, I was this angry, fearful young woman. And he said, "You will be an asset to my ministry." He said, "Will you marry me?" And I said, "Yes." The reason I said yes to both of them was all I knew is I wanted somebody to love me. And I was looking at who would I have the best relationship with. Well, this young man came home from the service. And the thing that I admired about him was the first time I saw him, his mother put a plate of food in front of him, gigantic. And he ate it all. And I said, "This is the man that has something that's real." And he said to me, "Dawn, you know, I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "That's so exciting." I thought of Hemingway and all these great people who were authors and that did great things that were alcoholics. Now, the only problem was I didn't really understand what an alcoholic was. I thought they were these creative human beings who hurt inside and needed someone to help them come out of their shell and become what the world wanted and who could conquer the world. And all they needed and all my husband needed was me. So when he said, I'm an alcoholic, and he said, I need you, that's all I needed. He said, I need you. Those other guys didn't say that. They were self-sufficient. But he said, I need you. And when he said, I needed you, it struck a chord within me. He needs me. And it was like a vibration was just went like that. And I said, this is it. He needs me. He needs me. And so 6 months later, and 6 months later, we eloped. We had a great courtship. Sometimes I forget about that. He didn't have a job. And he had the mustering out pay that he'd gotten from the Army. And he came over almost every day, went to museums. We went to movies. We went to plays. We just had a marvelous courtship. And I never saw him get drunk. He would bring me home and then he'd go and get drunk. But I didn't know that. He was so entertaining and he was very well read. And I was so impressed with him. It was a great courtship. I didn't know that when we eloped and we got married, the night of our marriage, the wedding night, he came in with a bag of German beer. And I had a bag of pastrami sandwiches. And the thought that hit to me, I can eat now because I have him. And he said he could drink now because he had me. And that's where we began. We began a journey of total insanity. I wanted to change him and he wanted to change me. I was this thin, attractive woman, and seemed like a month later, he came home from work and I had gained all my weight back. And I was filled with depression and self-loathing, and he had his own problems. And eventually he went to AA and his life began to change. The problem was he worked the first and the 12th step. He didn't think the middle steps were for anyone as intellectual as he. And I worked all the steps, but only in trying to change him. It took years for me to get to this program and realize that the inner workings of me had to be changed. I spent my life with, God gave me 3 more children, blessed children, and they were very brilliant children. And I tried to live through them and through their brilliance, because I always saw myself as a very, very average person, and they were always exceptional. I saw other people like that as being exceptional, and I was average. And so I put a lot of pressure on those children to be the best they could be. Not so much for them, but so I could shine. So people would say, oh, those are Dawn's children. You know, not that they are. Each individual's and children that belong to God. You know, I couldn't see that. All I knew is I needed them to shine for me. When I began the process at 44 of working on myself, a miracle began to happen. I realized that Dawn was wounded. And I realized I had to go back and get that little Dawn who was so hurt and so violated and take her by the hand and say, we're going to walk this journey together. It's going to be all right. I had to tell her that, all right, you've lost your son, but God has given you other children. And you have to be willing to wait and let go and see what God can do. That's the thing that's hard for people like us living in present time. We want to know what the outcome is going to be. We want to know what the answer is going to be. And what we find in these rooms is the ability to wait. My dad used to say, well, the answer to all problems is God and time. And I'd say, that's not enough. I want a solution. And when I worked those steps and I looked at myself, I realized that the solution is to wait, but not to wait and do nothing, but to wait and work those steps and see what God has for you to do. I worked those steps and I got from the inventory that looked at me and got little Dawn and got the teenage Dawn who had a child out of wedlock. I was 20 when that child was born though. But I was 19 when I got pregnant, and I had that was my first encounter with any kind of sexual behavior, and it was all ruined because I just felt violated. But what I found in that fourth step was that I had to go back and get that wounded young teenager and tell her it's going to be all right. It's going to be, God's got a plan for you. And I couldn't figure out what is it going to be. All I know is I'm eating compulsively. I'm fearful most of the time. I was afraid my husband was going to leave me. I was afraid he was going to stay. I was afraid my children would get in some kind of trouble, and it all pointed me. And all these thoughts that had no base, because I just had the thoughts that I wanted to fix people so I would look good. And there are four steps that it's not about your looking good. It's about your fixing a higher power or finding a higher power that's going to deal with your inner workings and make you well. And then I've got something for you to do. I got through that sixth and seventh step, and I was able through the fourth step, find out I had some character defects that kept me, that jealousy and fear and self-pity and resentment that kept me locked into this box, locked into this fat body. I couldn't get out, and I couldn't get out and stay out because I was so filled with the character defects, trying to be not who God wanted me to be, but who I wanted to be, and trying to impress somebody. And what happened through those steps was that, and through this understanding was, there's nothing I can do. I got to the seventh step and I talked about God. I have some character defects and I don't want to live like this anymore. And the first thing that God showed me, one of my chief character defects was jealousy. I was jealous of my husband who was coming through the program and doing well, who had become a successful man and who was managing one of the first HMOs in the country. He was doing that, and at that point he only had a high school degree, but he was teaching preventive medicine at Albany Medical College, and I was just so impressed with him. But I was jealous of him. I was jealous because he was very handsome, and all the women were calling him, and just scared me. It scared me, and so I was always watching. We were entertaining his staff one night, and I was standing with him. And he said to me on the way to the building where the party was going to take place, he said, "Dawn, I hired a new secretary." And I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I hope she's good. And I hope she's old." You know, and he said, she's an older woman. And there's no, you know, and so he was trying to get me ready for it. Well, when we got there and I was entertaining people and standing at the line, so that they could come up and greet myself and greet the director of the program. And this young lady in a miniskirt came up and said, "Mrs. Crawford, I'm your husband's new secretary." And I just froze. This cannot be a fact. He told me she was an older woman. And poor Peter looked over there and he could see I was drawn as he spoke. And he said, Dawn, come on. She was older when I hired her. He said he wasn't responsible for the change. And I said, "Well, you told me, you lied to me." And we got in the car and I fussed all the way home. And then he said to me, he said, "Dawn, does this have anything to do with your self-esteem?" And I said, How could that be? I was so angry. I got out of the car, rushed in the house, and I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor. I said, "He said to me, and let me tell you what he did. He said, does this have anything to do with your self-esteem?" And I just was so hurt. And she said, "Does it?" And I hung up the phone on her. I said, "What does she mean? Nobody seems to understand." And I got on my knees. I said, "God, I am having a problem here. I'm abstinent and I'm feeling all these things that are happening. But I need help. I got this character defect that I can't seem to do anything about it, and it is ruining my life. It definitely is ruining my marriage. Please, can you help me? And then I got up from there and I began to act as if. We were at a conference a couple of months later, and Peter was standing over in the corner talking to some young women. And the only thing I felt in my heart was love for Peter and for those young women. Now, I know God doesn't always work that way. You know, I know God has his own, but I know that God knew that if he didn't do something that helped me get through this particular character defect, I was going to stop and I was going to go back to food. So what happened was that was lifted. And I realized that if God could lift that one, he could lift the resentments and the anger and the fear, and he could change me on the inside. And if he changed me on the inside, I'd be a different person. And that's when I did ask God to change me, and I began the facts or the problem or the hope, really, of trying to set things right with those people that I had harmed with my bad disposition, with my fear, with controlling and all those things. And I began to change. And when I changed, I saw a difference in my family. I saw a difference in my relationship with my husband. What happened too was that when I was changing and bothering him, not bothering him, he worked with his sponsor, and little did I know he was changing too. And this man that I was on the verge of divorcing was the man that I fell in love with. And I fell in love with Peter. And then life was different after that, because his job was not to make me happy. His job was to work his program. And my job was not to make his happy, but it was to change and work my program. And our lives began to expand. We began to carry the message. And the ripple effect was that our children became successful human beings. They were doing well. And you know, the interesting thing is, I think God got us ready for life. He got us ready. My husband used to say, a ship is not meant to stay in the harbor. And sometimes life happens and it becomes difficult. I remember my oldest daughter told me she was gay. And I said, not in my house. And then the steps transformed and changed. Why not in my house? I lost my Lisa for a while. I didn't know where she was. She called me once from Boise, Idaho. And she said, Mom, I need to come home. I'm suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And she came home, and I was able to open my arms and welcome Lisa. And I watched her grow and change because I was changing. I was changing. And when you change, you can see things. I used to pray, God, please let me see her. And she'll see her. And I did. And her friends, let me see her friends as you see her. And when I did that, I didn't look at them as an abomination, as my church told me, but I saw them as children of God, filled with love and understanding. And that made all the difference in the world. My children, we've had interesting times. God gave me the children I was supposed to have. My son told me when he was gay, and you know, it was hard to accept. But I knew he was gay when he was a little boy. I used to say, David, what do you want to be? And David said, I think I want to be the flying nun. I said, wait, I think there's something else for you, David. And he said, okay, I'll be I Dream of Jeannie. I said, no, you could be. Then I said, let him alone. David was flying around the house with the preacher robe on. I thought he wanted to be a preacher. He liked that robe because the robe flew around the house. And it dawned upon me at some point, just love David. Love David. And some years later, David sat and talked with me. He said, Mama, I'm HIV positive. And I remember when he had tried to kill himself, and we took him to the hospital. And then I watched him begun to get better. I watched him, and he said to me, "Mama, you don't have to worry. I'm going to live long enough and see what the end's going to be." How far have I talked to him?
You have 11 minutes to 45. So you've talked a little over half an hour.
Oh my goodness, I thought I'd talk forever. David said that he was going to live and see what the end would be. And I remember my middle child was having some difficulties, and I flew to Chicago to she would have surgery, and I flew there to be with her. And as soon as I got her the surgery, my husband called and said, "I think you need to come home. David's in Virginia hospital." And I got there, and David said his stomach was extended, and he was in a lot of pain. And he said, "Mama, if God loves me, he's not going to leave me in this pain." And I looked to David, and he said, "Mama, if I could have loved anybody as much as you loved me, it would be enough." And when the doctor came in, he said, "David, you'll probably make it for about a week. But if we increase the morphine, David will die in a day or so." And I went in and talked to David. And David said, "Mama, if God loves me, he's not going to leave me in this pain. Increase the morphine." And my family and I got together and we talked. And he said, "Lisa and I were to make the decision." And we made the decision. And David died that night with us all around him. I almost prayed, and Lisa saying, "There's a bomb in Gilead." And I held his hand and said, "It's okay, honey. It's okay. You can go." And old David went home. I miss David all my life. But here's the thing was, when I would fill with this despair, I knew that the gift was that I had David. But I lost a son, and God gave me another son. And during that time, my sister had made a decision that she thought she was dying, and she had us all around her bed. And she said, "I got to tell you something. This boy that I adopted when he was a child, when he was a baby, is your son." And I was reunited with my firstborn. And I was talking to him at David's funeral. And I said, "You know, the two hardest things in my life were the death of my son and you coming out of my arms." But somehow or other, God sustained me during those times. And somehow or other, I remained abstinent because I had the power to lean on this higher power that I'd found in these rooms. That's a miracle to me. God prepared us on the journey for whatever life has. I was talking to a young man on the program one time, and he said, "Well, if you go through all this stuff, maybe it's best not to be in this program. Maybe life would be better if you didn't see things as they really were." And I don't know what to say to him. But all I knew is that the revelation of truth to us had set us free. The understanding of the steps had made us whole human beings. And so I would rather go through whatever life had with this understanding that I will never be left alone. And that there is this power that's greater than I am that can take us through the journey. You know, I lost Peter 2 years later. And I remember Peter was such a dear man. He said to me one day, I realized that he was dying. And I said, "Oh, my Lord, here I am. I lost David. I'm going to be all by myself again." And I went in and sat on the bed, and the tears started coming. And I said, "Peter, you're really going to leave me?" And Peter said, Dawn, he said, "Listen, I'm trying to die. Go call your sponsor." And I called my sponsor. She said, "You went to the firehouse looking for bread. You can't do that. I know you love him. I know he's got a strong program, but he doesn't have what you need today. What you need is grace. you need a sponsor. You need a relationship with God. You need the ability to let go and let God. And I could do that. I could let go of Peter. And I could watch the journey as he went from this group, this terrain to another. We got to the hospice place. And just as we got to the door, Peter said, wait a minute, stop. So what is it, honey? He said, look in the corner over there. He said, look in that corner. I see David. And I said, what? And he said, yes, look, there is David. He's come to get me. What a gracious, what a magnificent God I serve and found in these rooms. Because God sent David for Peter. I didn't see him, but Peter saw him. And the whole time he was in that room where he was dying, every once in a while he would talk to us, or we'd bring a meeting to him. And in the midst of that, he would look over and kind of nod at David, because he knew David had come to get him. And then after a while, the night came and the day came, and I was able to hold Peter's hand, and the rest of us were around the bed. And some of the people from the program were around the bed, and we watched Peter take his last breath. And I knew even at that moment that I would see him again. And that's the thing that gives me such comfort. I see him in meetings. I see him in places where recovery is abounding. And I see that this program has given us the tools to deal with life on life's terms, no matter what, and to find joy, even in times that seem like a struggle, that seem like things are not going to work out. I go back to a step and say, wait a minute, what step is this I'm on? And usually it's a step like the sixth and seventh step, or usually a step where I'm trying to control somebody or control the situation. And I go back to that, and I'm once again filled with the understanding, this is not necessarily about me. It's about living life on life's terms. And it's about showing other people that no matter what's going on, there's a power greater than yourself that can heal you and bring you out of this situation or through this situation. How many times have I spoken before a group of young gay men in a conference and have them come up to me and say, I'm sorry you found your son, because I wanted to be your son. And I say, well, I'm just gracious and grateful that I'm here and I can put my arm around you and hug you. You know, maybe that's why all this happened, you know, so that I could tell some other son who had been told that he was not welcome, that I could tell him, I see you as a child of God. I don't know what it's all about, but I do know that the relationships have changed with my children. I had one relationship, my oldest daughter got sick a couple of years ago, and she was very sick. We didn't understand how sick we were until we got to Maryland, where she was there. And at Maryland, they said she had a brain aneurysm, a brain bleed. And during that time, they did surgery. And when she came back from the surgery, she was just out like this, her mouth, she couldn't close her mouth. And somewhere in me, I knew at that time that no matter what they said, Lisa wasn't gonna make it. I said she wasn't gonna make it. And something happened during that time. Usually during that time, during the time of stress and stuff, my family would come together and we'd be strong together. And my middle child at that point became alienated from me, and that was very painful. I was losing Lisa and felt like I'd lost Alma at the same time. But God was gracious to me. He sent me some new children and new friends and sisters at that time. Amy was there, and Teresa was there, and Stephanie was there. And they ministered to me while my daughter hated me. But I understood too that my daughter was suffering from some mental disorders, and that it wasn't just me. She was in grief. She was losing her sister. But it was a very hard time for me, extremely hard time. But you know what? Life has hard times. Life has times when people you love the most are not necessarily able to be there for you because they got their own stuff. And what happens in this room, God will provide for you what you need to get through whatever the situation is. I said, I'm extravagant, God, you know? And those young women were there at my beck and call. And they, even after the funeral and I came home, they came to visit me, and they come to visit me. And they're the daughters, and they're the, they are just the people I have needed. And I'm so grateful for them. So the ripple effects have been good. Here's the ripple effect is I'm still standing. You know, I'm 91. I've had a lot of ailments here, and I'm losing my sight. And my response to that is, so what? Everybody has something. Everybody, sometimes I was in the hospital a couple of days ago. I had fallen, lost my balance, and wounded my side of my face and my, but you know, everybody has something. See, that's the thing. Before I came to this program, I thought I was terminal unique. You know, things only happen to me. You know, it's all about me. It's all about me. And this program has taught me it's not all about you anymore, that it's all about you. Life brings things. Life brings problems. But what it also brings is grace that can help you get from here to there. No matter what the situation is, there is a solution. Maybe the solution is not you, but the solution is surrendering to a power that's greater to yourself. That's why we do this 11 step on a daily basis. We ask God, please, you know, please help me surrender to you. We do continually take inventory. We surrendered him and asked God to direct our thinking, because unless we do that, our thinking is just a tiny bit off. You know, that's what I found out about myself as a compulsive eater, as a human being. My thinking is sometimes not on the beam, but I have these sources where I go to prayer and meditation and I ask for God's help, and I get back on the beam, and no matter what it is, I'll be given the strength to get through it. You know, I never reached any state of perfection. I used to think that one day I'm going to be perfect. But what I'm going to do is be on a journey that keeps me striving to be better and better. But it also has helped me understand that I'm all right. You're all right. That God loves you like you are. He doesn't want to change you. He wants you to be changed. And he wants you to want to change. And that's where the miracle happens. You know, if I had stayed there not wanting to be changed, I would have been in what I realized. Not only do I not have the power to change me, but I have the sense to realize I don't have the power to change me, but there is a power that will do that. And I want to be able to, at this point in my life, live with joy. I want the ripple effects to be that if you're in my presence or in my house, you feel that it's a house that belongs to a power that's greater than me. And it circulates around me, and it circulates around those who are around me. And around, that's what happens to you. This is not a thing that just happens to one person. It says that when our lives change, the people around us change. Sometimes they look for the old person. But, you know, God gives us the ability not to have to go there anymore. And we realize the old person is not here anymore. And there's a new person that's been created. And that creation is to be able to carry the message and to give hope to where you are, wherever you are. So my story is not over. The journey's not finished. My relationship with my middle child is okay, but it's not ever gonna be, I don't know that. It's better than it was, that's all I know. I've seen her only once since Lisa died, but I do see her on the iPod quite often. My grandbaby has a son, and he's marvelous little boy, very gifted. He said to me the other day, which I'm so proud of him, he's 2.5 years old, and he said, Zaba, that's what he calls me, he said, I peed standing up. Is that not a brilliant thing to say? that's my great grandchild, you know, what joy he brings me, you know, and how God just, if you stay in present time, God brings joy every day. You know, sometimes it's just in Amy and Jim gave me this flower that's not supposed to bloom any more than the one time a year. It has bloomed three times. Three times. Well, I might have missed that when I'm caught in just, I passed one day and I said, look at that. You know, some little thing. The other day, I couldn't open a bottle in order to get some sauerkraut out. And you know what? I opened it. I said, Lord, what a miracle today. You never know what the miracle is. The miracle might be that I find my glasses that I can't find. The miracle may be that I'm willing to ask for help. And that is the miracle. Not only to ask, but be willing and gracious enough to receive it. And I'm so grateful for people like you all in these rooms. Let's carry wherever we are the ripples of grace. And that's what we have. And that's the miracle of recovery. That grace keeps flowing and flowing and flowing. And one day we wake up and just realize, Lord, thank you. If I can wake up with thank you, another day, another opportunity to be of service and to serve you, and you serve me and receive the love so graciously given. Thank you. That should be an hour, right?
About 50 minutes. I wasn't going to say anything at 45. I thought about it. Went, nope, she's on a roll and I'm going to let her roll herself down to where she wants to stop. Okay. Turning off the recording. And.